Good afternoon, 3:51 p.m., and we are on the record in House Labor and Commerce for Monday, April 10th, room 124, State Capitol Building, and please turn your cell phones off or down to quiet. Members present, we have Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Knopp, Representative Birch, Representative Josephson, Vice Chair Wool, and myself, Chair Keto. Representative Stutz is not available at the moment, and we do have a quorum to conduct business. Our support staff today, Matt Kern as our LIO moderator, Caitlin Ellis as our recording secretary. Thank you both for being here. And we have a slight change in the agenda because of some availability issues. We do have three bills on the calendar, House Bill 38, Workers' Compensation Death Benefits, House Bill 9, Pharmacy Board, Employees, Drug Distribution Manufacturing, House Bill 124, Benefit Corporations. We do have some committee substitutes to adopt, and if there is committee support, I do intend on moving these bills forward. So the first thing we're going to do is bring House Bill 9 before us, Pharmacy Board and Employees, Drug Distribution Manufacturer. This bill is back before the committee. We do have public testimony open, but I would like to invite Richard Holt, if he's available, to place your name on the record and provide invited testimony for us, please.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Richard Holt. I am the Vice Chair of the Board of Pharmacy from Wasilla. Certainly, thank Mr. Representative Sadler for introducing this very important bill for us. It's a bill where we are requesting the authority to license and write regulations around that statute to have the ability to oversee the pharmacy supply chain of medication coming into our state for the patient safety aspect for our board. It's not uncommon for other states to have similar legislation for the safety of their patients. In fact, there are only Alaska, Hawaii, Guam, Utah, and Massachusetts that don't have a similar ability to license these wholesale distributors, et cetera. And so we're asking for that that same licensing opportunity to take care of our patients for our state and maintain their safety. In addition to that, we really need the additional assistance of an executive administrator to assist the board in all of the regulations that we're currently working on. And as pharmacy continues to evolve very, very rapidly to things that we're seeing elsewhere in the country, and we haven't even begun to touch upon in Alaska, which really impacts patient safety, we're asking for an executive administrator authority. So those are the two main purposes for this bill. And I certainly thank Representative Sadler for introducing this very important piece of legislation that we're trying to achieve.
Thank you, Mr. Holt. Any questions? I've got a question from Representative Knopp and then Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Holden, so did you mention Guam, Alaska, and Hawaii have not set up an inspection program? Is that what I heard you say?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, thank you. The information I have from the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy is that the last remaining areas that have not are Alaska, Hawaii, the territory of Guam, Utah, and Massachusetts. I have been informed that those other areas are actively working on pieces of legislation as well. They're just not finalized.
So just follow up to the chair. One follow-up question. So, you know, it's a good bill and in concept. I'm not opposed to it. I guess creating a position in this fiscal climate is probably where my reluctance lies. I'm not big on growing government. So my question for you is, if everybody else has had an inspection process and verifying the supply chain, you don't think that we are adequately protected by that? I mean, would you not think that the supply chains would be limited, and so if every other state or most every other state in the union is verifying that supply, you don't think that's given us adequate assurance that we need?
And thank you. Great question. I have seen And so I'll use a scenario. We currently have statutory authority to register out-of-state pharmacies, and part of that is reviewing out-of-state inspections. And I will tell you that some of the inspections that I have seen come in from other various states and show me great cause to be alarmed. Some of them have little to no detail at all, yet we accept them in that circumstance. And so having the authority ourselves as professionals in this field and licensed pharmacists and two public members, we feel that it's our profession to protect the patients in this great state of Alaska. And so really having the authority to do that ourselves as far as an inspection is concerned of what that looks like is important. We also have to really keep in mind that even if an inspection, and I heard it at the last conference as well, if they have an inspection, that's great, and if it meets our adequacy that we would write regulations to, if something happens, we still don't have the authority over that wholesale distributor or other facility if we don't have this piece of legislation. If they shipped something and something happened to the patients in Alaska, we could not sort of reprimand that facility. They're outside of our jurisdiction.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I had two questions, and one was almost already asked, but I guess the question was Massachusetts doesn't have any law like this, and they're they have a very strong medical community with a lot of hospitals, a lot of teaching universities. Do you know the reason they don't have a law like this, or are they working on it like you stated?
I have been told that Massachusetts is working on it in light of the compounding situation. I think in 2015, it was in one of the slides here, 2012, the New England Compounding Center was an unlicensed manufacturer that created some steroid medications, and based on their manufacturing, whether it was mislabeled, unsanitary, contaminated, resulted in 64 people dying and over 800 people sick from fungal meningitis based on what they shipped out across the country. So they are actively working on it. I do not know the current status of their process.
Follow up, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. We saw that case, and I remember when it happened as well. And so, and what I got from the bill sponsor the other day was essentially, or one of the testifiers, was that this bill sort of trying to solve a few problems. One of them is sort of in the compounding world where there may be bad actors, imprecise or unclean conditions, or if, for whatever reason, not practicing their trade very well. And also, as was testified by a pharmacist here the other day, that when he is tasked with sourcing out medication, sometimes he's approached by a, what do they call it, mid-level distributor that often is cheaper. So in the interest of saving money, he was going with these guys, these mid-level distributors that were perhaps not knowing what the source, the original source of the medication is, where it could be from various foreign countries and sort of untraceable and perhaps counterfeit. So that was the takeaway I got from that it was the sourcing of the medication that was in question and not so much the process. So, where's my question? and I guess I also share the concern of Representative Knopf in that you'd have to hire someone to sort of do more digging around for to verify these licenses. In other words, is it possible just to avoid mid-level distributors and just go with sort of certified big pharma distributors? Or is that not, is it the economics that's driving this?
To the chair, thank you, Representative Wolf. Yes, it would be very, and I don't purchase directly myself in my capacity with my retailer, but I think when you start limiting your sources and options for not only your patients of receiving those medications, but the economical side from a business impact, it's not the intention to limit business, It's the intention to make sure that the sources of these compounded medications, the wholesale distributors, et cetera, is licensed so that there's a comfort within the businesses, whether it's a clinic, a hospital, a retail pharmacy, that that we know at least something about that business. Right now, we don't license them. We don't know where things are coming from. We haven't sort of looked at anything. The EA position for this bill is paid for through the fees from these three licensing categories. And we talk a lot about wholesale distributors, but remember, these are three licensing categories that we're talking about in this bill to pay or fund the EA position.
Any other questions for Mr. Holt? No. Thank you, Mr. Holt, for your testimony.
Thank you.
And the time to call in. We do have public testimony open. I don't have anyone online signed up to testify. Is there anyone in the room that would like to provide additional testimony on House Bill 9? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. That brings the bill back before us. We do not have any amendments for House Bill 9. Do we have any committee discussion?
Just a quick comment.
Representative Josephson.
First of all, I think it's a very fine bill. And secondly, I think this is sort of a quintessential example, this bill, of how the public doesn't understand all the things the state of Alaska does. This would be way off people's radar. It was off mine until last week. And this would just be a textbook example of the kinds of things government has to do. I just want to make that comment.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the committee adopt.
Old page.
I move the CF for HB 9 version 30-LS0131-J be passed from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objection to the motion as stated? Seeing no objections, House Bill 9 passes from House Labor and Commerce. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Thank you.
We are back on the record, House Labor and Commerce, 4:07 p.m., and we are bringing House Bill 38 back before us, and we do have a committee substitute, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the committee adopt the blank CS for HB 38 version 30-LS0160-J as the working document.
Are there any objections to adopting the /J version of the bill? Seeing none, that is now our document, working document before the committee. And Representative Josephson and Mr. Kelly, can you place your names on the record and provide us with a update of the changes that were made to the bill? Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Andy Josephson, House District 17.
And for the record, I am Paul Kelly, staff representative Josephson.
Mr. Chairman, the changes are as follows. The first change is that in the previous version, the amount of money that would be received by the estate of a person who died without a spouse or children was reduced from approximately $125,000 to $70,000. And the reason for that reduction is that that's a more modest number, but it's pegged at the highest number afforded by a state in the United States, which is Louisiana, which is also at approximately $70,000. So it's not as ambitious an award to a single childless individual who dies, or to the estate of that individual, but it's pegged essentially using the Louisiana number. And mind you, there were other states. I think New York is at 50,000, so there were other numbers. The other change is there is a category of dependents, which is noted in section, I'll do it this way. It's noted on page 3, line 12 to 16 of the bill, where there are dependents, but there, so in my mind's eye, a person may be living alone, but they have people who are recognizable as legal dependents. So, for example, you might have a mother who's 80 years old and living in an independent living facility, but reliant on you for $1,000 a month. And it could be that your estate could prove that. So what we've done in that group, which I've just identified, page 3, lines 12 to 16, is we've reduced that number as well, which had been based on the whole body number of 255,000. We reduced that down to 100,000. So those are the main those are the changes in the CS. And what I'd like to do, because I think it's already gotten more complicated than it needs to be, is to tell the committee the two simple things this bill does. These are the take-home things this bill does. May I do that?
Certainly. Go ahead.
The first thing this bill does is, for the first time in Alaska history, if you never met, if you never married, and you didn't have children, your life when you die at work has legally recognizable value. And this bill would say it's recognizable as $70,000, whereas presently it's only recognizable in a funeral benefit of $10,000. That's the first thing it does. So, you know, in terms of water cooler conversation, I'd say we're paying homage and respect to single, childless people who die at work. That's the first thing we do. The second thing we do, the bill does, is it increases the permanent partial impairment whole body number from 177,000 to 255,000 to reflect an increase in inflation. So what we have, and I appreciate Paul putting this up, you see there the current law on PPI is 177,000. We're increasing that to 255. You have a document, I think, from Ledge Research that says if the consumer price index had been in effect the last 17 years, it would be 255,000. The way to think of this, ladies and gentlemen, is it's as if we're paying minimum wage at whatever it was in 2000. Maybe it was $7.25 an hour instead of now we're close to $9.75 an hour. We're stuck at $7.25 an hour. PPI rating is stuck at $177,000 an hour. That's $177,000 for the whole body, right? So this increases that to 255 and then links it to the consumer price index. And then you see for deceased workers, you see that under current law, see the title of the slide is current law. Look at the last bullet point. There's no provision for compensating the estate if there's no surviving widower or dependents. And that's so there's two different concepts. You might say, well, why are they in the same bill? They're both in workers' compensation statutes. That's why they're both in the same bill. So it's sort of like a mini omnibus workers' comp bill.
Can you advance the next slide?
So then you see, how do we fix it? In part one, we say the PPI rating properly, because remember, if it was proper that it was 177,000 in 2000, then it would be proper that it's 255,000 now. Because if it's not that now, then you're really saying it never should have been 177,000 in 2000, I think. And then you see where, in the next set of bullet points, you see that we're increasing, if you look to the second to the last bullet point, when you have other dependents, but they're not necessarily the dependents you think of that live at home, but they're dependents, and a court would say, yep, they rely on you. Okay, we're increasing that number from 20,000 to 100,000. Now, that number, the $20,000 figure, hasn't changed since 1968. So the amount of money that we gave, it's here in the middle of page 3. The amount of money we gave to those dependents has not changed in 50 years, about 50 years. And then the real reform, along with reforming the PPI, is increasing, or not increasing, it's not increasing, it is creating a damages award, basically a workers' comp award, for the person, for the estate of the person who dies unmarried without children.
Thank you. Questions for the sponsor, Representative Knopp?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, and for committee's information, we also have the Director of Risk Management, Scott Jordan, in the room, and Director of Workers' Compensation, Marie Marks, available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Olson, I guess the question for me is why? I mean, on page 3, line 19, if there's no widow, widower, child, children, dependents, we want to pay the estate $70,000. My question is why? Why?
I'm really glad you asked. Here's why. There's basically three things we can do with single people who I think of them as 20-somethings. They could be 70 years old, right? There's three things we could do. Nothing. We could leave the law the way it is. But imagine, through the chair, Representative Knopp, imagine if you were talking to the parent of somebody who had a 22-year-old child, like Abigail Cottle did, or rather her mother, she's the deceased, Marianne Burke did, whose daughter Abigail Cottle died at the workplace but hadn't met her spouse. Many of us look to do that, and she hadn't done that yet. She hadn't accomplished that thing. She hadn't born a child. These aren't criminal things. She just hadn't done them. And she died at the workplace. And in effect, we're saying all Raven Electric had to do, they did have some OSHA fines, but all they had to do was cut a check for her funeral expenses. How would you have that conversation with Marianne Burke, her mother? How do you do that? And I think part of it is there's no other way to get around this but then to say her value, the value of the single person's life is less to the legal system than everyone else. And note, again, that other states provide this benefit. This has been a benefit that in the CS is cut almost in half, down to $70,000 from about $125,000. And don't forget that it would create a little further incentive for a company to say, we better have a safe workplace. And finally, my final statement is, remember, this is an exclusive remedy. So these single childless people cannot sue. Their estates cannot sue. So I was thinking about this, and then I'll wrap up. Imagine if you were in an elevator as a customer, not you, but imagine if one was in an elevator as a customer of a business. Maybe you were at a massive Nordstrom somewhere, and the elevator came crashing down, and two people died in the elevator. One was a worker of Nordstrom, a young lady who'd never married or had children. The other one was a customer of Nordstrom. Here's what would happen. The customer could collect potentially millions of dollars in damages. They may have just been talking to each other in the elevator before the elevator came crashing down. The worker, under Alaska law, would receive nothing. Two lives experiencing the same thing. This is an injustice we can correct. And I would note that the research done on this from Ledge Research, which you have a copy of, says that there is not an appreciable amount of workers' comp impact. So, for example, the state of Oregon said that a change in these benefits would not materially affect workers' compensation premium rates due to the small number of compensable deaths each year.
Mr. Chair, I just follow up with a question, Representative Olson. So, but the scenario you just used is not an apples-to-apples comparison because the customer who perished in the elevator accident would collect under civil or criminal litigation.
Mm-hmm.
An employee's family would have the same option. Customer would not collect under workman's comp litigation. So I think I'm not sure it's an apples to apples. Why would an employee not be eligible? Employee's family. Why would they not be eligible under the same rules that apply to the customer as far as civil or criminal if something in the elevator?
Well, I'm happy you asked it, just so I can doubly clarify. Title IX is our personal injury or torts statute. It's sort of the rules of the road for personal injury damages. Title 23 is our rules of the road for workers' comp. In my elevator example, the worker, her benefits in Alaska, or him, would fall entirely. It's whatever this statute says you get, you get. What does that statute say you get? $10,000 funeral expenses, period. And if you go like Abigail's mother did to the Supreme Court, I think ultimately they're going to say, we can't help you because the people in Juneau can't help you or won't help you. And I would note that, just as I did in the last hearing, she did go to the Workers' Comp Board or Commission, and it said, quote, these policy arguments must be directed to the legislature, as they no doubt will, in connection with currently pending legislation introduced following Ms. Cottle's death, et cetera, close quote. That is the bill before us. So the ultimate answer to your question is, it's not like you could really, really try to file wrongful death, and maybe they'll let you do it. It is 1,000% prohibited. If it's not in the workers' comp statute and you're a worker, you don't get a benefit. Everyone else, the customer in this hypothetical, they're deceased, but their family at least gets a feeling of, you know, this is going to be recognized. You know, you should have checked that elevator shaft. You didn't do the maintenance. And we're going to come after you for damages as appropriate. The customer's family would get that. The worker's family would not.
Follow up. Thank you. Yeah. Representative Birch.
This has to be hugely frustrating to attorneys. You know, when I look up workmen's through the chair, I look at workers' compensation. It's a form of insurance providing for wage replacement and medical benefits to employees injured in the course of employment. So I'm an employee. If I get injured, so there's a medical benefit and there's a wage replacement benefit. And you're talking basically here life insurance. And I can, I can see where, you know, I mean, great, it's, you know, they pay to bury you, but it's, you know, I struggle to understand how workers' comp migrates over into a life insurance policy, and I think that's effectively what you've done. I mean, we've already got tangled up with unemployment insurance. I mean, who knew that unemployment insurance basically pays for training people at the University of Alaska? I mean, employee training, you know, for somebody else to take your job. So here's a little slice of an employee's workers' comp, you know. In other words, every employee's got to pay, an employer has got to pay a chunk of money for workers' comp. And then, but I understood that workers' comp is for medical benefits and to replace wages lost due to, you know, injury. What prohibits any employee from going out and buying, like I bought, you know, a large insurance policy? If it's life insurance that anybody wants, that's freely available and marketable. And I'm interested in how you migrate workers' comp into kind of a life insurance deal.
Well, through the chair, I mean, first of all, it presumes that an unsophisticated person in their early 20s would think to themselves, I could die at this job. I need to provide some remedy for people who care about me. It's not a fix for unsafe workplaces. So it doesn't solve that problem. But, you know, I'm adding a Section 6 to a death benefits section where there's already death benefits being paid out. But, you know, do recall that other states do this. And, frankly, at this point, it's a fairly modest award. It doesn't – I don't know what the risk assessment folks will say. But it's not going to materially change the workers' comp rates. And I just think that fundamentally, you know, I mean, here's the other part of it. There really are only three options. Do nothing, do something like this bill, or offer these single childless people a chance to sue their pants off. Okay? Now, under wrongful death. Now, note, they would then carry the burden by a preponderance of the evidence that they themselves weren't negligent. That they shouldn't have seen, you know, maybe they should have seen the banana on the stairs, and anybody knows that they're bright and yellow, and they should have seen that and not fallen down the stairs, that sort of thing. But note this, if I was an employer, I'm not sure I'd want the third option. because the damages total in workers' comp could be far greater, far greater. I think if, given that other states are doing this, I think this is, if I were the employer, I'd say, I can work with this, you know. I just think otherwise we're in the situation where we're literally saying, I just don't know how it just seems highly unjust.
Follow up.
Well, it seems the Department of Labor, somebody has, I mean, if they find an unsafe work condition, they can go in and kind of sue the pants off of them. I mean, I've seen them level, you know, $100,000 multi, you know, I mean, very significant fines against employers that are operating in an unsafe condition. I mean, I think there's a lever or a mechanism there for that to happen. I guess the piece I just, you know, I'm trying to get my head around is the fact that, you know, you do have somebody there that you know, for whatever reason, you know, doesn't choose to buy life insurance, but has, you know, that we're trying to migrate a workers' comp, which is based, you know, and I mean, all I hear about workers' comp is how expensive it is. That if you're a steel worker out here, that or somebody that employs a steel worker, that, you know, there's a huge wage component for workers' comp. And you know, even in modest, you know, maybe safer type jobs. So I mean, everything I hear is that workers' comp rates through the chair are high and getting higher, and this doesn't seem like it's really going to mitigate the cost of workers' comp. And I guess I would be interested in what sort of additional cost component. I mean, hopefully, it's not very significant, and that there's not too many lives lost in a year that fall into this. But that might be helpful information.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of your reasons, statements, Representative Josephson, was that how to have the conversation with the family. Obviously, that's a very difficult conversation, and it's a very unfortunate event, whether the individual has dependents or not. So whether they're childless and spouseless or whether they have a family, the conversation is going to be extremely difficult, I would think. In some ways, agree with Representative Birch that workers' comp is one thing. Workers' comp insurance covers certain things. Life insurance covers other things. And I understand that the amount that was originally allocated was only for the expense that the estate would realize for the funeral, which $10,000 seems like a paltry amount, and I agree. So I guess what you're saying is that by adding more, it just sort of takes the – makes a bad situation a little better. I mean, is that kind of what is taking the, is it making a bad situation better?
Through the chair, yes. And I will say this also. You know, I mean, last year we had in Anchorage, I think in Midtown somewhere near where I live, there was a hole dug in the ground. And the man is sent down into the hole, and the hole gives in, and he dies. Now, you know, I don't know. I think he was a young man. I wouldn't be surprised if he was single and childless. I mean, the difference through the chair, Representative Wohl, is it's one thing to go to the other family and say, the state really has a remedy for you, to the widow or widower and children. There really is something concrete that will offer you a modicum of solace. It's another thing to go to the other person and say, you know, your child didn't have any kids and never married, and they say, well, can we sue? No. You can, but they'll throw it out the next day. Well, is there some damages claim? No. Is there an award from workers' comp? No.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess, I mean, you're just highlighting a problem that I'm surprised, as are others on this committee, that let's say I work for a company and they give me the company car to drive one day, and I'm driving down the road and all of a sudden the brakes don't work and I drive off the road and I'm killed. I would think I have some legal recourse for negligence, and that, you know, people could sue. I know I'm getting nods of no, but I just find that so hard to believe, that if it was some blatant negligence, that, you know, like you say, if the customer gets hurt, they can sue them to full extent of the law. But if it's an employee that gets hurt through negligence, I guess it's shocking. But so the other thing is that, let's say an industry like fishing, where maybe more people die in the fishing industry than in, you know, the restaurant industry or something. So if this benefit were to be enacted, and let's say there's a lot of maybe young men that fish that don't have dependents, would this I don't know if it would affect the
through the chair. I think that the Jones Act or other maritime acts, and I took maritime law many years, decades ago, would answer that. I tend to think that fishermen aren't covered in the same way. I bet Representative Stutz knows more. But I would say that, so I think fishing is a huge carve-out under federal law, often in terms of Jones Act damages. But in terms of the breaks give out, it was negligent of the company, and I think that's essentially what you just reported. I really offer you this assurance, Representative Wohl, that it truly is the exclusive remedy. Now, it could be, it may be that, I want to make sure, it may be that, and if Ms. Marks is here, it may be that if the brake manufacturer could be sued, independent of the company that owned the car for which the brakes gave out, there could be some possibility of litigation. I bet Ms. Marks would know more about that. But truly, workers' comp is the grand compact which was designed to end litigation. Of course, it never really did that. There's lots of litigation in workers' comp.
So we do have Representative Wohl does have to leave, so I'd like to get to her for a question. Did you have?
Well, I guess I can hold my question. I don't know if. Mm-hmm. But in relation to fishermen, they are independent contractors. They are not covered by workman's comp at all, so this wouldn't apply. And I guess my other comment, and it's more of a comment through the chair. Thank you. I'm sorry. My other comment is more of a comment than a question. It just seems odd that we would have any kind of law that would make a carve out where we would have to go and say, as the representative said, your child has no value. And that's very difficult for me when it's an easy remedy to fix. It's almost inconceivable to think of it along those lines. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Knopf.
Who did you say had to leave, Mr. Chairman?
I do.
Oh, okay. So Representative Jolson, so I got to tell you, I'm not getting any warm fuzzies, but so I'm going to ask you some questions. Instead of putting the death benefit into the workman's comp bill, I'd rather seen legislation that would allowed members, surviving members, dependent or not, to have a course of legal action against an employer for something unjust. As you say, there is nothing in the statute. But what gets me in this is you do have a death benefit in line 27 of page 2, you got a $10,000 funeral expense, and then you still want to give $70,000 to an estate of somebody who has expired that has no dependents, and you have it tied to the rate of inflation. So I have issues with that, but more importantly, even on your partial impairment, and I'm going to say, Representative Jolson, that you obviously you think at a different level than I do, and you've written this, and so you're much more intimately familiar. So it takes me longer time to grasp the concept, but I'm going to take a look at page 1 on line 12. When you got impairment partial in character but permanent in quality, not resulting in permanent total disability, the compensation is 255. But then on line 1 of page 2, it complicates it. Multiplied by the employee's percentage of permanent impairment of the whole person, or permanent impairment of the whole person, and the percent of impairment, it's complex. And I guess
if I could,
yes, please,
through the chair, Representative Knopf, two things here. First of all, as to your first point about the $70,000 on page 3 being tied to inflation, it is not.
Okay,
it is a fixed amount. So, okay. 20 years from now, somebody might $70,000 may not seem like what it is now, and someone may ask to increase it when you and I are likely not here. But that is a fixed amount. In terms to your second question, that is existing law. So your concern with, for example, page 2, line 1, is a concern with existing law, not my bill, which is fine. It's just not my bill. What my bill does is grow the number from $177,000 to $255,000. And by the way, that is not the amount you get. That's not really the amount that anyone really gets. that's sort of a base amount from which a permanently damaged appendage or bodily organ would be multiplied.
Follow up, or?
I think, Mr. Chairman, are you planning on moving this soon or holding up for another meeting? Because I'd like an opportunity to maybe visit with the representative one-on-one outside committee to fully understand. I'm not going to understand it.
The interest was in trying to move the bill today, so we did have some changes in the CES
That's fine. If you want to move it today, I'm just... Yeah, okay, that's fine. Thank you.
And just if I may, for the record, there are about a dozen other states, our alleged research says, that does this. Minnesota, 60,000. New York, 50,000. Louisiana, if this offers you any comfort, Louisiana actually is $75,000. And if the reference is right, it's for each surviving parent. So Louisiana's award is actually $150,000.
Any questions, more questions for the sponsor or for Division of Risk Management or Workers' Compensation? No. Would there be objection to moving with individual recommendations?
I'm not going to object to moving it, Mr. Chairman, but I will be a do not pass on it.
That's fine. Representative Bull.
I move the CS for HB 38-30-LS0160/J be passed from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay. Any recommendation or any objections to the motion as stated? Seeing none, House Bill 38 passes from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note, and we'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Thank you. Okay, 4:38 p.m. We're back on the record at House Labor and Commerce. We have House Bill 124 before us with a committee substitute. Representative Wool.
I move the CS for HB 124 version 30-LS0348/D be passed from adopted as a working document.
Okay, and I will object for purposes of discussion, and I am going to trade places here. Ms. Carpinetti?
Watch out.
My name's here. I'll stay here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for the record, my name's Sam Keto. I am representative of District 33. And before you, you have a committee substitute for House Bill 124, Benefit Corporations. We did hear that bill briefly previously, and we did have some changes, mostly technical, but I do have my staff, Bianca Carpinetti, here to provide further explanation of some of the changes, and then we'll be available for questions.
Thank you, Representative Keto. Ms. Carpinetti, you want to go over the changes for the bill?
Certainly. For the record, Bianca Carpinetti, staff to Representative Keto. Before you, you have version D. There are five changes that I'd like to address in this version. First, we standardize the use of the term general public benefit. Since it's a unitary concept, it does not take an indefinite article, and so there's some inconsistencies in the bill where there was an indefinite article. You'll see this change on page 5, line 29, page 9, line 7, and line 24, page 10, line 7, and page 11, line 2. Second change is we changed reasonably to rationally in keeping with model legislation establishing benefit corporations. This change occurs in four places, twice on page 6, lines 9 and 11, and then on page 9, lines 17 and 19. Third, we removed, quote, for general public benefit purposes to avoid redundancy on page 15, line 7. Fourth, we deleted the word purpose in order to use the definition of those terms in the definition sections without tying them to the public benefit corporation's requirements. This change occurs on page 15, line 11. And finally, we changed the effective date to July 1st, 2018, page 17, line 7. So that covers all the changes in the CS. I also have some follow-up from questions from the committee from last time that I'd be happy to read through if there are no initial questions on the technical changes that we made in the CS.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none,
Okay. So Representative Knopp had asked about examples of benefit corporations. So there are many types of businesses that have become benefit corporations since the first law was passed in Maryland in 2010. The benefit corporations currently incorporated in the United States come from a range of industries, including retail, manufacturing, tech, service, professional services, private education, and food and beverage production. They come in all sizes, from one-person service companies to large-scale international brands. A few examples of well-known benefit corporations include Method, Kickstarter, Plum Organics, King Arthur Flour, Patagonia, Solberg Manufacturing, Laureate Education, and Alt School. The committee had also asked if they had to be publicly traded. They do not have to be publicly traded to be a benefit corporation. The legal designation of a benefit corporation does not set requirements as to whether or not a benefit corporation is publicly traded or privately held. There are currently around 5,000 benefit corporations throughout the United States, and only one of them is publicly traded. The first benefit corporation, Laureate Education, went public in February of 2017. There was also a question about why the need for a benefit corporation if it isn't publicly traded. So most of the 5,000 benefit corporations through the United States are private companies. However, many have also taken outside capital in the form of venture capital or private equity dollars. And so being able to protect your mission over time and consider stakeholders is incredibly important to these entrepreneurs, especially when they raise outside capital. There was a couple questions from the committee about a special taxation benefit conferred to benefit corporations, and there is no special tax benefit conferred. The benefit corporation status only affects requirements of corporate purpose, accountability, and transparency. Everything else regarding corporation tax corporation laws and tax laws remain the same. So they still have to elect whether what type of corporation they are, whether that's C or S. Representative Wool, you had asked about Newman's Own and if they were an example of being a benefit corporation. I have found no indication of Newman's Own being registered as a benefit corporation. Rather, Newman's Own gives 100% of its after-tax profits to the Newman's Own Foundation, a private nonprofit foundation, which in turn gives the money to various educational and charitable organizations. While Newman's Own, the way they operate is commendable, it's probably not a good example of a benefit corporation, because being a benefit corporation means the business is run in a particular way. So if a company were a poor employer and had bad corporate citizens in the community where it operated but gave away some of its profits, that would not make it a benefit corporation. The focus of benefit corporations is on being profitable in a responsible way, not what they do with their profits after they've been earned. Representative Wool, you had also asked if tax laws changed, would benefit corporations be exempted? And getting back to the sort of earlier question, tax-wise, benefit corporations still elect to be either C or S corporations. So again, this benefit corporation status only affects the requirements for corporate purpose, accountability, and transparency. Everything else regarding their tax status remains the same.
We have a question from Representative Birch.
Just to understand, so with the example through the chair of Newman's Own or Microsoft, I mean, if Bill Gates, you know, decides to give $50 billion or everything he owns to, the net result, I mean, he operates it as a regular corporation. Whoever owns those shares can direct those however they choose, if they want it to go to a charitable purpose or not. So I'm still trying to understand the merits of a benefit corporation. I mean, it seems like if you you can do the same thing. There's not a tax benefit that I'm aware of. I'm just trying to understand what the motivation is. I guess I don't disagree with it.
But. Through the chair, Representative Birch, and so one of the things that was mentioned is really it's a culture of social responsibility. So a corporate structure that would allow individuals within the corporation, as well as the earnings of the corporation, to be utilized for a tangible, beneficial purpose. So with just a profit motive or fiduciary motive, then the profits could be used for a charitable purpose or not, but as we heard from Mr. Zaterno last week, they want to operate their corporation with a culture of being responsible and giving back to their community. And they can do that by registering as a beneficial corp, which allows them to be accountable to their shareholders, but that their shareholders would also expect certain behaviors from employees or directors or others, so not just a profit or a charitable giving motivation.
Yeah. Follow up. Yeah, so what's the advantage of doing it in that manner as opposed to just a not-for-profit, just setting up as a, you know, the United Way?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, so there are significant differences between the services provided by a nonprofit and the services provided by a profit. So if I operated a for-profit corporation and I made a widget and I sold the widget, that would not be, I don't know that I would be able to convert that into a nonprofit organization. And if I did, the 100% of that benefit would go to the nonprofit. It's about cultural sensitivity and giving back to the community. And depending on what form a particular owner or a board of directors would want to take for their corporation, they can structure with this bill a corporation that would allow them to do what they would like to give back in their way. So say it was a company that might be a mountain guide company, and rather than just making a profit, they have their employees do 20 hours of community service in some respects once a month, and that could be part of their corporate culture and their bylaws, so that whole corporation is committed to giving back to some component to the community.
Okay, thank you. And if I may add to that, it seemed like in our conversation with the gentleman from Anchorage last week, it can be used as sort of a marketing badge, you know, saying this is how we run our company and another reason to support them.
And through the chair, Representative Birch and Representative Wool, that is one of those things that's identified specifically in the bill, that really it's not a designation for marketing purposes, but you can definitely utilize it as a selling point of your company and what you might be able to offer.
If I may add to that, Representative Birch, through the chair, corporations are also generally expected to put the interests of their shareholders sort of as their primary consideration. And there are two cases that have sort of set the precedent for this. One is Dodge v. Ford Motor Company, and the other is eBay Domestic Holdings Incorporated versus Newmark. And both of these cases affirmed that all activities of a for-profit corporation must seek to maximize the economic value for its stockholders. So it's important to note that the benefit corporation status is needed to protect mainly directors from being sued in a derivative suit. So it's a legal protection as well for them to say that they're going to add the consideration of their mission in addition to their economic impact.
Cool. Thank you.
Any other questions? I think it's the will of the committee to move this bill out of.
Thank you.
Move this bill out today.
You have an objection still.
Oh.
That's right. Do you want to move it?
I will be vice chair for now.
Mr. Chair, I remove my objection.
Okay.
To adoption of 30LS0348/D.
I move the CS for HB 124 version 30-LS0348/D be passed from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Am I back?
I guess. I don't know. I got confused.
Seeing no objections, House Bill 124. Is passed from committee with individual recommendations. We will take a brief at ease. Actually, we'll go ahead and wrap up this committee, and then we'll adjourn if you can stick around, and we'll sign the paperwork. For Wednesday, we have on the agenda House Bill 83, Teachers and Public Employee Retirement Plans, House Bill 142, Unemployment Compensation Benefits, and we may have another bill previously heard, depending on how things go. We might actually have a new bill to consider. So. We will be trying to let you know if we have other bills that will be coming before the committee. With that, we will adjourn House Labor and Commerce at 4:51 p.m. Thank you, everyone.